And in some of the instances, as I told Bryan Cranston, I said, you know, Bryan, I'm not a very good actor. He laughed and said, and he guessed otherwise. And I said, you know, I built Robert Musella just as I was trained to as an undercover agent. I was trained to build a persona that was as close to me as it possibly could be. And if you look at the two supposed people, and me, the real person, and Robert Musella, both born in the New York City metropolitan area about the same time, to Italian-American parents, with a college degree in business administration finance, having worked in a bank, having worked in a brokerage firm and operating businesses, and knew how to be a businessman. Well, you know, I was all of that.
Voice of Robert Mazur, a former US Customs special agent who went undercover in the 1980s on a mission that exposed Pablo Escobar's money laundering ring. He's played by Bryan Cranston in a new film about his time undercover. We'll hear more about his amazing story today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead,
every film is screened at midnight in a big theater. We've got a 1,200-seat auditorium. And so this is where films that are kind of a little more extreme live.
We'll touch down in Toronto to hear from one of the programmers at this year's film festival. Plus,
yeah, I mean, they very quickly became this kind of huge celebrity filmmaking couple. It's kind of hard to compare them to anyone today in terms of how big they were.
The new documentary uncovering North Korea's bizarre attempt at sparking a film industry by kidnapping a director and an actress from South Korea. All that plus the hard-hitting journalist of Australian television who really just wants to be in musicals. That's all ahead today on The Cinema Show right here on Monocle 24. In the mid-1980s, Robert Mazur was a happily married man living with his wife and child in Florida. Like a lot of people, he would wake up in the morning, put on a suit, and he'd go to work. But Mazur's work wasn't quite what it seemed. In fact, when he was at work, he wasn't even Robert Mazur at all. Hello and welcome to The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Ryland, coming to you from Midori House in London. For 2 years, Robert Mazur posed as Bob Musella, a corrupt businessman at the helm of several dodgy companies. As a government agent, his job was to infiltrate a circle of money launderers, working for the notorious Colombian drug lord Pablo Escobar. Basically, he was paid to go out drinking at strip clubs with some of the most dangerous people you can possibly imagine. Mazur is played by Bryan Cranston in a new film that tells the incredible story of his life undercover, The Infiltrator.
This is what I do. I'm an undercover narcotics agent. I sit with murderers and made men, and I lie. I lie my ass off.
Bryan Cranston as Robert Mazur in The Infiltrator. I spoke to the real Robert Mazur this week. He joined me from the US, where I began by asking about some of the first undercover jobs he ever undertook and how that prepared him for the big one.
Well, first, you know, there are a myriad of things that are done to cause you to raise your awareness to how you really communicate. You don't just communicate by your appearance, by your mannerisms, but also by the words that you choose. There are many different ways in which you speak, by the clothes you wear, and really heightening your awareness to that so that you eliminate as much as you can the communication that might otherwise not convey accurately the persona of your undercover identity. You also need to be very, very aware of the potential of developing some signs of Stockholm syndrome, whereby you may have an operative that for one reason or another makes mistakes and creates in their own mind a connection to some of the targets of the investigation in a in a way that is bringing them somewhat ideologically even closer to them than their colleagues. This is a problem that's happened in many long-term undercover operations, and I know in the UK in the recent past there have been some very tragic stories.
There are a few moments in the film where it looks as though you've come extremely close to certain death. There was actually a moment where a surveillance operation was uncovered that, well, it seemed to stir a lot of suspicion in your direction. Can you tell me about that?
Unfortunately, the management in New York felt it was really important for them to attempt to surveil the people dropping off the cash in $1 and $2 million increments. I ineffectively argued against that because I thought that it would be best for us to keep the lowest possible profile. We had just won confidence over to do certain things that were very unique. But regardless, there was a lot of surveillance out there, and sometimes we don't give the bad guys enough credit. They had twice the number of counter-surveillance as we had surveillance, and they picked up on everybody who was out there. So the word came from Colombia that the belief was that I was an undercover agent, and I needed to somehow find a way to be able to turn that thinking around. So I asked for and got a one-on-one meeting with a person who was very close to the person accusing me. The person accusing me was Gerardo Moncada, who was the most important manager to Pablo Escobar at the time. And so I asked for this meeting, and I asked for it not, I begged for no surveillance, no cover team, and just said, you know, I've got my phone with me. I know the hotel room I'm going to. You know where it is. I just need you guys to stay back and just let me run with this. Let me try to get the thinking turned around. And that was agreed to. I went in. I left my briefcase recorder in the car, went into the room. Really didn't know if it was going to be, as I was told, a one-on-one meeting. It turned out it was. And the person who was there, a representative of Moncada, was a person who I had kind of developed a rapport with. And in the course of speaking with him, again, this goes back to my training, I took a posture in the meeting that was not defensive. I did not try to pound my chest and get upset about people accusing me of being an undercover agent. I simply said, listen, you know, your people have discovered something that's very valuable to you, but it's very valuable to me. Whatever problem exists, we have it together. We need to help each other. I don't know what side of the transaction the problem is on, but if it's on your side, I suspect you'll take care of it. And if it's on my side, I can guarantee you I will eliminate it. We just need to make certain that we have the best information from both of us. So we kind of took on the approach of doing it as a team. This guy was waiting for some Swiss bank records. I went out to the car. I got my briefcase. I didn't want to bring it in because it had a recorder in it initially until I knew I was alone. And I brought the recorder in. I threw it on the bed. And as we talked further, I noticed his eyes glancing very frequently to the recorder, to the briefcase. Eventually, I took the briefcase on my lap and I opened it. So the back of the briefcase was looking at him, and I was the only one who could see what was inside the briefcase. He was exactly opposite me. As I opened it, the hidden compartment for the recorder let loose, and the recorder fell into the body of the briefcase, along with a nest of wires. And I was trying to act as nonchalant as I possibly could as I was trying to put this thing back together again. And he was getting impatient, waiting for the records. So he finally got up and came around, and I got that back together again within a split second of when he came around to get the records. And I would say the combination of being accused, knowing that at least the train of thought at the time was that I was an agent, and having that malfunction happen was probably collectively the high point of nervousness that the Robert Mazur brain was experiencing during the undercover operation.
Robert Mazur, former U.S. Customs Special Agent. He was speaking to me from the United States. The Infiltrator is out in theaters now and available to stream in some markets too. The Toronto International Film Festival wraps up this weekend. One film attracting a lot of attention is the romantic musical La La Land, starring Ryan Gosling, the science fiction drama Arrival, starring Amy Adams, and, of course, the new film by Tom Ford, Nocturnal Animals. But you probably won't find any of those in the lineup overseen by Colin Geddes. As the man in charge of the Midnight Madness and Vanguard sections, he tends to attract a crowd hungry for something a little off the radar. Colin spoke to Monocle's Chris Frey.
Well, TIFF really is about the audiences. And, I mean, other festivals are sometimes just more exclusive and industry-based. I mean, Cannes is really not, at least the main selection, is not really a public festival. Even the smaller selections are kind of more directed kind of like diehard cinephiles and students. So the general public, it can be daunting and hard to get tickets. Here, the whole city flocks to support and come out to the festival. And I've gotten that feedback from directors themselves, where they notice that this audience is a regular audience. This is an audience, this is really a festival for the people.
And yet, nonetheless, it still is an important spot for industry and the market to appear.
Underneath all of the stuff that you're reading about, the films and the red carpets and the premieres and the interviews with the directors, there is the film commerce. Okay, so the film industry is going on. So films are being bought, films are being sold, films are being pitched, films are being financed. There's a lot going under the surface that the average moviegoer wouldn't quite know.
You program the Midnight Madness series as well as the Vanguard section, or contribute to the Vanguard section. And the Midnight Madness series is one of those signature features, I guess, of TIFF that really does play to the public, the audience aspect of it. Tell us a little bit about Midnight Madness and how you program it.
Yeah, the Midnight Madness selection has been going on now since 1988, and it was brought about because we realized that there is this kind of void where genre films really weren't being accepted and screened at film festivals. And, I mean, these are still art. This is still art. It's like, okay, well, let's put these films at midnight, make it a little more dangerous, a little more edgy. And, I mean, the first year, I think they had, like, Hellraiser 2, Decline of the Western Civilization, Metal Years, Penelope Spheres documentary, so stuff which really had a raw edge to it. So as the title suggests, every film is screened at midnight in a big theater. We've got a 1,200-seat auditorium. And so this is where films that are kind of a little more extreme live. My programming criteria is you've seen maybe 2, 3, maybe 4 films during the day. This is your last stop. You need to be woken up. So I pick a film which is going to grab your attention in the first 10, 15 minutes and keep it for 90 minutes. So that can be horror films, action films, martial arts films, black comedies.
How is TIFF coping with some of the larger changes that we're seeing in the film business and the film world, whether it's the, you know, the struggles of the big blockbuster films to the more intense scrutiny that films seem to receive these days?
It's really interesting because, I mean, oftentimes people assume that the film festival is about Hollywood films. But really, it's the press is writing about those Hollywood films. And for every time you read a story about a Hollywood film, you're missing around 5 different stories about foreign films which are connecting with their audiences.
Festival programmer Colin Geddes there in conversation with Monocle's Chris Frey at the Toronto International Film Festival. This is The Cinema Show. We'll head to North Korea next.
Do you like good films? Well, you're in luck. The Cinema Show is presented in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. And we've got a special treat happening at the moment. Just for our loyal listeners, a whole month of movies for free. Head over to MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Because life is too short for bad films.
The Score. Brought to you by The Cinema Show. Born in the Bronx in the 1950s, Cliff Martinez is one of the most stylistic and slick composers of our time. Martinez started out by making a name for himself in the music industry, most notably as the drummer for Californian outfit the Red Hot Chili Peppers, but since has been crafting superb scores for both independent and Hollywood films ever since his debut silver screen offering in Steven Soderbergh's Sex, Lies and Videotape. M- Martinez has become a muse for an eclectic collection of iconic directors, most notably Soderbergh and more recently Danish filmmaker Nicholas Winding Refn. His exceptionally unique and experimental approach to composing has created luscious, haunting and epic landscapes for films such as Contagion, Traffic, Solaris and 2016's crime war comedy War Dogs. Martinez's scores seamlessly transport his audiences through some of life's most raw emotions, while simultaneously building a sonic vista for the cruelest crime lord, a damsel in distress, a relentless lawyer, or possibly even a getaway driver, desperately trying to get the girl. For Monocle, I'm Kieran Banerjee.
You're back with The Cinema Show here on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. There's not a whole lot known about the personality of North Korea's late dictator Kim Jong-il. Like the Hermit Kingdom's current commander, Kim Jong-un, a key part of his rule seemed to be maintaining a frightening veneer of mystery and unpredictability. Something we do know, however, is that he really loved movies. As bizarre as it seems, he dreamed of North Korea competing on the global film industry stage. It was an interest that would forever change the lives of two of South Korea's film royalty. It's a story that would be utterly unbelievable if it weren't true, and told in such a compelling fashion by the directors Robert Cannon and Ross Adam. They popped into Midori House to walk us through their new documentary, The Lovers and the Despot.
Shin Sang-ok always wanted to be the best filmmaker in South Korea. He wanted to have his own studio, and he met with Choi Eun-hee, and she was an emerging actress. In fact, she was more successful than he was at the time they met, and he'd seen her on screen and thought, wow, I want her for my movie. So he cast her in one of his films, and from there they had this affair, which led to a lifelong romance.
Yeah, I mean, they very quickly became this kind of huge celebrity filmmaking couple. It's kind of hard to compare them to anyone today in terms of how big they were. But because he was a studio boss as well as a director, people often say, like, kind of Steven Spielberg of Korea at the time. She's being compared to Elizabeth Taylor, Marilyn Monroe. I mean, that's the kind of level that they were.
Well, let's just go back to Hong Kong. When Choi disappeared and she'd gone out there after an affair had broken their marriage, that's Shin's affair with this other actress, a younger actress. She'd gone out there to follow up another film opportunity, and she just went missing. And so the family was looking for her. No one really knew exactly what had happened, just wild speculation. North Korea had entered a little bit in that speculation, but no one really knew. And obviously, it was only well after they'd escaped that everybody knew what the story was. Even whilst they're in North Korea, it was very shady stuff. Did they go willingly? Were they kidnapped? And our film attempts to get deeper into that mystery. Strangely enough, Choi's own recollections of this, most of the time, were quite humorous. And I think maybe that's one of the ways she dealt with such an experience, that she decided this is just a funny episode of her life. But yes, when she was taken, it was very much like a thriller movie. She didn't really know where she was going, why she was being taken there. She kept on asking people for answers, but no one would give her a straight answer. And she had one rough bit of information that when she's on the boat, she asks, you know, where are we going? And one of the guys says, into the bosom of Kim Il-sung. And she faints at that point. Kim Jong-il, ever the director as well as dictator, stage-managed this little photo op. I don't know exactly why, what he expected to happen. He obviously brought her over, so she's his captor. But he wanted this photo, I guess, for posterity, for a memento or something of the occasion, so had a photographer shoot her. And so this is all captioned there on the film. You can see that she's not exactly delighted to meet Kim Jong-il. I don't know whether he could quite read that sentiment exactly. Maybe that was beyond his powers. But yeah, he, like so many other occasions, he ordered someone to do something. They did it for him, and he's got a photo op out of it.
Also, we quite quickly noticed there was something else going on in the way that she talked about Kim Jong-il and North Korea. She was much more reticent than we expected to criticise them and to speak ill of Kim Jong-il. And at first we thought maybe that was fear of repercussions. And actually at the time that we interviewed her, it was shortly before Kim Jong-il died, so he was still alive at the time. But as time went on, we realised that this is perhaps something else is going on. This felt like Stockholm Syndrome, some sort of identifying with her captor. And surprising as it may be for someone who'd kidnapped her and held her prisoner for several years, they harboured a sort of sense of guilt at having eventually betrayed him and ran away. I mean, we always knew we didn't want to paint North Korea as just this comic caricature that does appear mostly to the West. It's fairly obvious that it's a terrible place with unknown level of oppression. I guess we had the same feeling about Kim Jong-il as a kind of wacky dictator, but we knew that wasn't going to make a good film. You've got to get behind that. Why would he do this? What are his motivations? How did he become this terrible person? And the key to that was all in these secret tape recordings. And not just obviously the personal recollections of Choi, but the tape recordings are really the key. And they do show that he is more aware, perhaps more chillingly aware of the situation. And he calls his country kind of like kind of school level kind of education rather than the college level that's outside. He knows the failings of the system, but doesn't really do anything to change it, which I think is a bit more chilling. Beyond that, I think that we always wanted to give the audience a sense that, yes, these people are performing, and performing is obviously funny, and aesthetically it's kind of just this wacky thing to us in the West, but what's behind this? What are they feeling? Especially when you see them crying. There are the funerals of Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung. You see them weeping. And I've always watched those and thought, wow, this is like, there's a kind of terrible beauty to this. It's like these, like, what can they be thinking? Is this just a genuine emotion? They've been so propagandized that they feel this and it's a euphoric thing and they're just all crying. Or is it just they are just acting? Either way, it's very intriguing, and that's something we try to show in the film and make people feel emotionally. There's a potency to the images beyond just them being wacky. 8시 30분에 현지 지도의 길에서 급병으로 소거하셨다는 것을 가장 비통한 심정으로 알린다. Robert Cannon and Ross Adam, directors of The Lovers and The Despot, out in theatres next week. And finally today, listeners in my home country, Australia, will probably know Lee Sales as the formidable host of the 7:30 program on the ABC television network. Since taking over the role 6 years ago, she's quickly become a household name across the nation thanks to her fearless technique in the face of some of Australia's most powerful politicians. If you're unfamiliar, well,
here's a quick introduction to Lee at Work.
Let's quickly run through some other issues, Prime Minister, starting with the economy. When Labor left office, unemployment was 5.8%. It's now 6.3%. Growth was 2.5%. It's now 2%. The Australian dollar was 92 cents. It's now around 70 cents. The budget deficit was $30 billion when you took office, and now it's $48 billion. How do you explain to the Australian people that you were elected promising, in your words, to fix the budget emergency, yet in fact Australia's economic position has worsened under your leadership?
Well, I don't accept that. The boats have stopped.
We're talking about the economy. Taxes,
the boats have stopped.
Now, even if you'd watched Lee Sales at Work every night, you might still be surprised to know that she's actually a big fan of musicals. And I don't mean a casual observer. She's a passionate devotee. Here she is in an outtake from an interview that she did with the comedian and musician Tim Minchin.
Hey, Tim, I've written a song about you coming on the show tonight.
Yeah, I know.
7:30 tonight, you're in for a delight. Tim Minchin is my guest, he's quite sublime.
I'm totally sublime.
But if a couple of gingers offends, well, I cannot make amends, and you'll have to go across to Channel 9.
Never!
Now, Lee also hosts her own podcasts along with her ABC colleague Annabelle Crabb, where they mostly just chat about movies, books, and whatever else caught their attention that week. But I've often wondered, what kind of musical would Australia's foremost political interviewer love the most? So I gave her a call. Hi there, Lee.
Hey, Ben. How are you going?
I'm going well, thank you. Now, thanks for chatting. And now, look, I know you need to maintain that air of professionalism when you're opposite prime ministers and treasurers and whoever else. But I wonder, we were talking about movie musicals a couple of weeks back, and being such a big musical fan yourself, what's your pick for the best musical ever?
Oh, A Chorus Line, because you can't do better than a musical about musical theatre, in my view. And also, I think the music's fantastic, and I love the story and just the sort of heartbreak at the end when everyone's just done their best and they're all absolutely awesome. And then just the nature of Broadway is that some people can make it and some people can't make it. And so I love that story. But also, I'm thinking stage musical, but my all-time favourite film would be Singing in the Rain, which I think is just a flawless piece of filmmaking. And the fact the musical is almost incidental, I just think it's a flawless film, but it's also, you know, right up there. So it depends if you're asking about stage or film.
Oh no, we'll happily take both of those. So let's say you were to walk away from the 7:30 desk one day to try your luck on Broadway or on the big screen, what would your dream role be?
Oh, geez, I've never really thought about it. See, I'm not really good enough to do any of it, so it's actually just a complete, you know, pipe dream, any of that sort of stuff. I mean, who wouldn't want to be Gene Kelly, frankly, in Singing in the Rain if you had to have any role? Because then you get to actually do that number and sing in the rain and do Singing in the Rain. So, I mean, you'd want to be Gene Kelly, wouldn't you? Why would you bother going for sort of anything below that? If you're going to have a fantasy role and aim high, might as well just go straight to the top.
Lee Sales, thank you very much for chatting today. And that's it for today. Do join us next week. We'll review this year's live cinema festival that's just wrapped up over in Rome. Today's show was edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. Catch up on the podcast over at iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. The Cinema Show is back next week. I'm Ben Rylan. Thank you for listening.
Let the stormy clouds chase everyone from the place.